Tonight on Arena, we celebrate the life and work of the great Maggie Smith, and Niamh Burry plays live in studio. +51551 is the text. You can tweet the programme at RTE Arena. Well, you may well have heard the sad news that the great English actress Maggie Smith has died, known as one of the great actresses of the stage and screen. Maggie, who was 89, found megastardom in her late career when the younger generations as Professor McGonagall in the Harry Potter franchise. Let's hear her taking and bestowing marks upon her charges.
5 points will be taken from Gryffindor for your serious lack of judgment. As for you two gentlemen, well, I just hope you realise how fortunate you are. Not many first-year students could take on a fully grown mountain troll and live to tell the tale. 5 points will be awarded to each of you for sheer dumb luck.
And for all the family, Maggie Smith found fame in her Emmy Award-winning role as the acerbic Violet Crawley, Dowager Countess of Grantham.
Swallow it, Granny. It's stuck in your craw long enough.
Well, don't worry about me. I cobbled it up long ago. It's your father who seems to have difficulty swallowing these days.
Maggie Smith there, and to concentrate on her recent work would be to ignore one of the finest bodies of work by any actor. I'm joined in studio this evening by Stephen Benedict, a fan of Maggie Smith's, who will talk us about such classics on the line. And on the line by two of her co-stars, her friend Niall Buggy and Mark O'Halloran, both of whom starred with her on her last film, I do believe, Thaddeus O'Sullivan's Miracle Club, the story of a group of Dublin women who visit Lourdes in search of cures and reconciliation. Delighted, as I say, to have Niall Buggy, friend and who was in that film with her, and in fact his friendship and professional relationship with Maggie Smith goes back a long way, and Mark O'Halloran, who played the local priest in the Thaddeus O'Sullivan movie. Niall, as I say, that friendship of yours with Maggie Smith goes back a long way. I think today's news saddened you greatly.
Oh, it's very, very sad indeed. And I mean, she was a great, great actress, and I loved working with her. I think I worked with her about 25 years previously, but I saw her on stage quite a lot. She was extraordinary to watch on stage. I saw her in The Beau Stratagem, and I saw her in Lettuce and Lovage, and also in Talking Heads by Alan Bennett.
Yeah. Talk to me a little bit about that Lettuce and Lovage situation, because many of us, as I say, Niall, will know her from the screen, but you watched and saw her in action on the stage, in particular in Lettuce and Lovage, the Peter Schaefer play, where she managed something quite difficult in the midst of all the liveness of theatrical presentation and performance.
It was an extraordinary thing she did, actually, because I had seen it already, Letters in Lovage, in London, and then I saw it again on Broadway, and she had a very long speech to give, which may not necessarily have been the greatest written speech in the world, however, and very good, I'm sure, but she had to say it to Maggie Tysak, and in the course of saying this speech, she had to put her coat on, and I remember it so well. In putting the coat on, she got it. She turned it inside out, upside down, without noticing that she was doing this, and all over the place. So, I mean, I'm actually laughing now because I remember it so vividly, all the things that she did with that coat. And then at the end of the speech, it was on and she was off. But my God, she was a great, great comedian. Wonderful.
Yeah, that kind of that ability for physical comedy. But looking at her on screen, she could make you wither, or make those acting opposite her
absolutely
wither with a look. Was she like that in real life? Could she wither you with one look?
She could. I mean, luckily enough, that didn't happen to me. But she could be very, very sharp and say things, you know, like, I mean, she was asked what she thought about Glenn Close one day, and she said, Glenn Close, that's not an actress, it's an address. Anyway, that's the sort of thing that she would say very quickly and off the top of her head.
Yeah.
But she didn't like being impersonated, so I better not do that.
No, you better not. Mark O'Halloran is also on the line with us. Yeah. And Mark, of course, you worked with her on, you worked with Maggie Smith on what we believe is her last film, the recent Thaddeus O'Sullivan film, The Miracle Club. You helped her with certain parts of that performance.
Well, I did get to sit down with her and teach her how to say the rosary, which is kind of one of those bizarre things that happen to you in life. You sit down with a living legend and you go through, I don't think either of us really were that familiar with such sacraments or whatever. But it was, during that film, I mean, I remember getting the phone call to say, you know, they're offering you this part. And it started with, well, Kathy Bates is in it. I was like, oh, my God. And then Laura Linney's in it. And I was like, oh, my God. And Maggie Smith. And Maggie Smith, of all people, was legendary, you know.
Mm.
I'd watched her since I was a child and things like The Prime of Miss Jean Brodie and all that. I had seen her on stage as well. I saw her in A Bed Amongst the Lentils on the television, and then latterly when she became super, 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 super famous. And she came also with a reputation, I suppose, of being fierce, which I was really looking forward to, I have to say. I mean,
Did you get any withering look maybe when you went into the second or third decade?
No, she was incredibly kind to me and very nice, and it was full of fun, actually. She was physically a little bit frail at the time, but she was full of fun. I do remember I was sitting with her after I had taught her how to say the rosary with her rosary beads. And there was we'll call him a man who used to be around the set. He might have been a money man, a tall, slim man who used to stand and watch the action. And it used to really annoy her that he was standing there. And one day he turned up and she turned to me and went, oh, look, it's Mrs. Danvers. And like she had all these sort of nicknames for people and gags going on. And she was effortlessly funny. She was also incredibly professional. She, you know, even with her physical frailty at that time, her acting chops were like out of this world. You know,
yeah, well, let's listen to her. Let's listen to her in action as Lily. In fact, the husband, you played the husband, Niall. We'll come back to you. Niall Buggy played the husband. We'll come back to you on that particular aspect of things in a second, Niall. But here she is as Lily with her fine Irish accent, it has to be said, with that other pair that were part of this great trio of women heading the cast. Eileen, played by Kathy Bates, and Dolly, played by Agnes O'Casey.
Is everyone set? Everyone ready? Well, here we go. This is what we came for. Now, be strong. Whatever you might say, the heartbreak of the world is upon us.
Is that someone dying?
It's the water. They say it's bitter cold.
Jesus.
They're not stepping in the same water as us, are they?
Oh, of course they are.
But that's a bit much. They'll be catching infections.
Oh, no, you won't catch a thing. This is Lourdes. It's another miracle. Our Lady told everyone to come and bathe in the miraculous water.
That's the man. It's a miracle he's after walking. It's a miracle.
Get him in
quick. Our Lady's here.
There we go. That is Maggie Smith as Lily, Kathy Bates as Eileen, and Agnes O'Casey as Dolly, testing the temperature of the water in Lourdes. And notable that she called it Lourdes within that. The last time I spoke about this film, Niall, I was corrected by somebody who said to me, it's Lourdes, Sean, not Lourdes. And it definitely is Lourdes if you're doing an Irish accent. But you played her husband. You played opposite her in that, Niall.
Yeah.
What was that experience like?
Well, it was great. I mean, I had a whole day with her, you know, just the two of us, and the cameraman, of course. Anyway, but it was wonderful. She made it easy, you know. She made acting easy. When you're working with somebody like that, and they speak to you, you forget. You know, you just forget what you're doing, and it just was. It was a dream. a dream come true for me, really. Yeah.
I have Stephen Benedict sitting opposite me here in studio this evening as well. And I suppose, Stephen, if we want to talk about the breakthrough moment for Maggie Smith, we have to go back quite a bit in time. She'd had a big success with Othello, which she played in the National Theatre and was subsequently made into a film.
Yeah, that was directed by Laurence Olivier, his adaptation of Shakespeare's play. And she was also received an Oscar nomination for that film. Mm. And then 5 years later, I think two of her most celebrated and her best performances actually were earmarked for other actresses.
Yeah.
The Prime of Miss Jean Brodie was originally played on stage by Vanessa Redgrave. And then when it came to the movie, they were expecting Vanessa Redgrave to reprise the role, but she didn't. It went to Maggie Smith. And the brilliant thing, I think, I mean, both of your guests there have alluded to her fantastic comic timing. But another thing about Maggie Smith was she was able to portray incredible vulnerability.
Yeah, because the thing about Jean Brodie that it's easy to forget from the Mirror Spark novel, although there was an adaptation.
J. Preston Allen did the play, and it's actually, it's the movie's more based on the play than it is in the book.
That it is on the book itself. But Jean Brodie has some very, very dubious notions as a teacher.
She does. I mean, this is the great thing, one of the great things about the story. You know, when we think about movies about teachers, we usually think about, you know, Sidney Poitier to Serve with Love or Robin Williams in Dead Poets Society. But here in the Prime of Miss Jean Brodie, she plays a lady who has got remarkable fascination with Benito Mussolini and General Franco. And she's actually misleading the young girls in her charge. And there's a fantastic climactic scene in the when she's actually facing dismissal. And the way she turns the scene on the headmistress of the school is quite remarkable.
Let's have a listen to her in action in Miss Jean, the Pride of Miss Jean Brodie.
I am a teacher. I am a teacher first, last, always. Do you imagine that for one instant I will let that be taken from me without a fight? I have dedicated, sacrificed my life to this profession. And I will not stand by like an inky little slacker and watch you rob me of it. And for what? For what reason? For jealousy? Because I have the gift of claiming girls for my own. It is true, I am a strong influence on my girls. I am proud of it. I influence them to be aware of all the possibilities of life, of beauty, honor, courage. I do not, Miss Mackay, influence them to look for slime where it does not exist. I am going. When my class convenes, my pupils will find me composed and prepared to reveal to them the succession of the Stuarts. And on Sunday, I will go to Cramond to visit Mr. Lowther. We are accustomed, bachelor and spinster, to spend our Sundays together in sailing and walking the beaches and in the pursuit of music. Mr. Lowther is teaching me to play the mandolin. Good day, Miss Mackay.
Maggie Smith there as Jean Brodie in the Prime of Miss Jean Brodie, the film that really was her breakthrough, and she won a best actor for that. Stephen mentioning to us, Niall, the fact that if you wanted to think of the two really big performances, particularly in terms of film in that early part of her career, the next one you would probably talk about would be The Lonely Passion of Judith Hearne. I think this was your first. Both professional and personal, the beginning of that relationship with Maggie Smith.
Yes, that was the first time I'd worked with her, and that was amazing. I mean, she had been a friend of Siobhan McKenna's, and so she told me that she used to babysit for Siobhan Donica O.D., who's a little older now, and. And so we got on very well together, and then I did a little scene with her in the kitchen, playing one of the tenants of that house.
And in terms of, you know, we got a sense of it there in the Prime of Miss Jean Brodie, where she has that big speech, which isn't that common, let's face it, in a film to get a speech of that size. But she had so much stage experience under her belt in those terms, Niall. Did you see a difference in the stage actor and the screen actor? Was she able to make that shift seamlessly?
Absolutely. I mean, the thing about it is she was always truthful. You know, it was always truth, based on truth, everything she did, as all great actors do. And she was amazing to watch and observe. And there is something very sad about her death, apart from the fact that she has left us, is that the 1960s, I think Laurence Olivier created maybe one of the greatest acting companies ever. And, you know, she now that Maggie has gone, I don't think there's anybody left. Well, maybe Edward Petherbridge, yes, he's still with us.
And in fact, a text in from Shane Donegal, who makes the point that Maggie features very well in Irish cinema. Don't forget her heartbreaking performance as a troubled Dublin woman in The Lonely Passion of Judith Hearn opposite Bob Hoskins. And Stephen, that's interesting here because it was the location was shifted to Dublin, and perhaps that babysitting for Siobhan McKenna was a help for her.
Yeah, it's adapted from William Trevor's novel, which was actually published in 1955. When it was published, it was set in Belfast, but initially when it was published, John Huston optioned it very, very quickly with the intention of directing Catherine Hepburn. And Catherine, as great as Catherine Hepburn was, I think we've got to thank the cinema gods that neither of them went near that picture. And I think the wonderful thing about, again, going back to Maggie Smith and her brilliant ability to be comedic but also incredibly vulnerable, because it's a heartbreaking performance. And I would describe it as actually claustrophobic, because it literally takes your breath away. She is waiting for a miracle to come and save her life, and it never arrives. And the sadness, and it's just a depletion of life. And she went down to the last morsel of her DNA to deliver it. It's one of the greatest performances I've ever... I saw it when I was 18 in the cinema. And, you know, in my very, very limited experience, I said, oh, this is important. I've got to really pay attention to this.
It was obvious to you even at that point. Mark O'Halloran, as we finish up, how will you remember? I know it was a brief encounter with Maggie Smith, but I'm sure it's a very important one. How will you remember her?
Well, I mean, it was very special because I was aware that she was part of this almost royal lineage. You know, she had worked with everyone from Olivier. Bergman directed her in the theatre. Like, she was this extraordinary actress who had lived an extraordinary life and achieved massively. So it was just a great honour, you know.
Yeah. And Stephen, you wanted to say something?
Yeah, I just want to say that, I mean, as Niall was saying, the great acting company that Laurence Olivier put together, sadly, she is the first of the great dames to leave us. We've got Dame Eileen Atkins, Dame Judi Dench, Dame Joan Plowright, and most recently Dame Vanessa Redgrave. She was recently bestowed with that. She's the first one to go. And I don't want to depress anybody, but these are very, very elderly ladies.
Hugely important actors. Niall, I'll leave the penultimate word to you, because I think I should leave the final word to Maggie herself, obviously. But I'll leave the penultimate word to you. Remember her for us, if you would, Niall, as both a friend and an actor.
I just have to say very quickly that she also did Young Cassidy, you know, The Life of Sean O'Casey.
Oh, yes.
The film that was made. And she played Nora in that. I will remember her with great joy, because that's what she gave us.
What a lovely way to finish. Niall Buggy, Mark O'Halloran, Stephen Benedict, thanks so much for being with us. But I will leave the final word to Maggie Smith as the Judith Hearn in The Lonely Passion of Judith Hearn.
I've been waiting for you. Years I've been waiting. Years, every one of the 12 months. Praying for it. Hoping. A woman never gives up her hopes. It's always a Mr. Right, they say. Changing as the years go by. Well, you know, he's tall, dark and handsome in the beginning, and then... Well, you're not so young, and he's middle-aged and funny-looking and common as dirt and... Dread anybody, and anybody so much as gives you a kind word. And that's your prince. Sent to keep you from being alone, and love, don't talk, that's forgotten. You're just supposed to take him, even though you know he doesn't want you. All he wants is an American quick lunch.
But Judy, we do have things in common. You're a fine woman.
Do you see me as a woman, Jim?
Why, sure. At least we're doing something together. Together something.
Those alone doesn't mean you're nobody. You don't exist.
Brilliant. Maggie Smith there as Judith Hearn in The Lonely Passion of Judith Hearn. Her death was announced today. She was 89. Just a correction, actually, that I should have picked up on at the time. The Lonely Passion of Judith Hearn, as Ruth Walsh tells us quite rightly, was written by Brian Moore, the Canadian Belfast writer. Now, moving on to Niamh Berry, who released her debut album on the Claddagh label in March. The album received critical acclaim for its storytelling, its genre-blending sound and lyricism, and songs that managed to strike a balance between personal reflection and broader issues of contemporary society. Ahead of her headline show at Liberty Hall and the release of her latest single, Geordie, I'm delighted to be joined in studio this evening by Niamh Berry, who has along with her Joe Potter, two of them with guitars. We're going to hear the single that is being officially released next week, but getting its first outing here on Arena this evening. Geordie from Niamh Berry.
Oh, as I roved out over London Bridge on a misty morning early, there I spied a fair pretty maid who cried for the life of her Geordie, saying, saddle for me a milk white steed, saddle for me a pony, and I'll ride down into London town to beg for the life of my Geordie. For he never stole ox, he never stole ox, never murdered any, he stole 16 of the king's wild deer, all for to feed his family. And when she came into the king's hall, there were lords and ladies plenty. Well, down on her knees she did fall, to beg for the life of her Geordie, saying, six pretty babes had I by him, nor the one lies in my body, and I would part with each one of them if you give to me my Geordie. For he never stole ox, he never stole ox, he never murdered any, he stole 16 of the king's wild deer, all for to judge. He looked over his left shoulder, he says, I am sorry for thee, my fair pretty maid, you've come too late, for he's been condemned already. Well, me Geordie shall be hung in chains of gold, such chains as ne'er were any, because he came of the royal blood, and he courted. And I wish I was in yonder grove where times I have been many. My broadsword and my pistol too would fight you for the life of my Geordie. For he never stole ox, he never stole horse, he never murdered any. He stole 16 of the king's wild deer, all for to feed. He never stole ox, no, he never stole horse, he never murdered any, he stole 16 of the king's wild deer, all for to feed his family, all for to feed his family, all for to feed his family.
Niamh Berry with her version there of the song Geordie, and alongside her was Joe Potter on guitar. I'm not surprised that it's a story. It could be called the Ballad of Geordie, really, couldn't it, Niamh? I'm not surprised that it's a story that you're telling in that song, because that was what was all over the album for me. I was listening back to it today, Yellow Roses. It was full of storytelling.
Yeah, exactly, yeah. Yeah, I'm very into traditional song, really, for that reason. They're just such great stories.
Where did you find that song? Where did that come from?
So I first heard that song actually by the singing of Martin Carthy, who's an English singer. He actually just played in Dublin last night. But he's an English singer. And yeah, I heard his version, which was just amazing. So yeah, I just really love the, in particular, the female character in that particular song. Has a lot of grit and gall.
Yeah, to stand up and kind of plead the case in front of the judge. And the great lines, never stole ox, never stole horse, never murdered any. He stole 16 of the king's white deer for to feed his family. It gives you the real sense of the humanity of the situation.
Yeah, big time. Yeah, and I guess it's just one of those traditional songs that resonates through the ages.
Yeah.
The
debut album, we spoke about it back in March when you were released, and it was coming out on Clara, on the Clara label, and that was a big moment that Clara were kind of rebooting, if you like, and you were very much part of that. Huge reaction to it. You must have been delighted. I'm thinking of, you know, the cover feature on the Sunday Times Culture magazine in and around the single of Beehive, and lots of people talking about how you were kind of breaking down genre boundaries and telling great stories here. Must have been good for you personally to hear that and read that.
Yeah, no, it was lovely. I'm really proud of the album and everyone who worked on it. So it was really nice that people were actually listening to it and responding to it. I suppose that's all you can really ask for. So,
Geordie suggests to me that you have at least one, if not several, songs ready to go. Are we heading towards a second album, or where are you at with that?
Yeah, I'm chipping away all the time. So Geordie will be a single on its own. But yeah, I'm kind of definitely writing. So
yeah,
we'll
so
see.
The new songs as well as the tradition. Yeah. So this upcoming headlining your own gig in Liberty Hall, you by yourself, is Joe going to be there? Are there others going to be there?
Joe will definitely be there. I don't know if he'll be on stage yet. We haven't
decided that side of things.
Yeah, but there will be a band, definitely. Mm. So a lot of people who played on the album will be on it. And I'm really looking forward to it. I've been playing a lot this year, and it's probably going to be my last Irish show of the year.
Last Irish show, but are there moves afoot to go a bit abroad further afield?
Yeah, well, I'll be in Scotland in November, and I'm going to be playing Other Voices in Wales as well over the Halloween break. So, doing a little tour of the Isles, I suppose.
Yeah.
Yeah. But the Liberty Hall show is the 8th of November. So,
8th of November. Yeah. Look, I'll give people full details of that in a second, but you are going to sing a second song for us.
Yes.
You're going to go back to the album, the title track. Is there anything you want to tell us about Yellow Roses before we hear it?
It's a song I wrote about my grandmother, whose name was Mary Berry. So so she passed away a few years ago, and I wrote this song as kind of a collection of memories, I suppose, I have of her.
You're telling her story in some ways is what you're doing here, isn't it?
Yeah, I suppose so. So yeah, we'll give it a whirl.
We'll remember Mary then as we listen to Niamh Berry with Yellow Roses.
Yeah.
You always said you preferred animals to people. I know you commune with ghosts, yellow roses in your garden, blue skies and the ones you love the most. September, wartime notes are sung vibrato, glamorous beyond compare. Judy Garland, rollers in your hair. We're doing fine.
That's how to remember your grandmother if you're going to do it. Granny Mary remembered there by Niamh Berry in her song Yellow Roses. A beautiful guitar playing, perfect synchronicity between Joe Potter and Niamh Berry in that performance. You can see Niamh on the 8th of November headline show at Liberty Hall in Dublin. Tickets are available on singularartists.ie. And so we go into the final section of Friday night's programme. Time to take a listen to the latest album releases. British electronic maestro Jimmy XX returns with his solo album In Waves. Nearly a decade since he released a full-length project, and in the years since he's quietly contributed production work. Many major artists, Frank Ocean, Miley Cyrus, Tyler and the Creator amongst them. Also on the menu tonight, Tipperary native Gemma Hayes. Her 2002 debut, Night on My Side, earned critical acclaim, was nominated for the Mercury Music Prize and made her only the fourth Irish artist to receive such an honour. Now, two decades later, living in West Cork, Hayes returns with Blind Faith, first studio album in 10 years. Juggling parenthood and creative rust, she admits that getting back into music has been a challenge. And finally, Come and See, much anticipated debut album from the Irish band Gurriers. Founders Dan Hoff and Mark McCormack worked together in a 24-hour fast food restaurant before the pandemic, where they dreamed of starting a band. After enduring lockdowns, their debut gig at Dublin's Workman's Club launched them on a fast-rising trajectory. Delighted to be joined in studio this evening by Louise Bruton and Eamon Sweeney, who have been listening to all three albums. Let us start with Jimmy XX and a track called Treat Each Other Right.
We got
And off they go out onto the dance floor once again. That's Treat Each Other Right. It's not the opening track, it's the second track on the Jamie XX album In Waves. Eamon Sweeney, you were the first one to be almost running out to get up on the floor to dance there. It really is a banger, and there are lots of them on this
absolutely.
Album.
Absolutely. I think partly, Sean, that's come as like the just hearing that song sets me off. Very happy memories of last Sunday night when I saw Jamie do a very intimate DJ set in the Concord in Brighton to launch the album as part of a small series of parties. And it's joyous. Like that night, the first thing that jumps out about this record is how lively it is, how life-affirming it is. It's extremely poppy. It's extremely commercial. It won't be for the dance purists. But I think for anyone, and of which there's many, including myself, who've been following his career through the XX and the debut album, there's a lot to love here, I think.
And I suppose one of the things that Jimmy XX has noted for Louise is that not only do you get the bangers and the dance floor hits, you get this kind of more introspective side to the music as well. Is that present on this album, In Waves?
It wouldn't be present in the sense that you get from the XX, which is all very kind of low and all very kind of looking inwards forever and always and into the big sphere of darkness. But In Waves is very much full of colour and it swerves between genres quite beautifully. The track there that you play there, Treat Each Other Right, and Wanna, the leading track on that on the album, they go between lovely disco, kind of chill, dreamy dance music, and then garage music. It's all kind of the highs and the lows are all celebrated here.
And you were making notes about samples on that particular track.
Yeah, we got to do with to Treat Each Other Right, which is such a beautiful statement. It's from an old Detroit soul classic by Aletta Lattimore. And Jamie's obsession with soul music, I think, is very apparent. He does a series of regular shows on the digital radio station NTS, which are brilliant. And again, you know, echoing what Louise was just saying about just being so eclectic, soul is something he dips into an awful lot of this.
Yeah, and let's have a listen to another track a little bit further down the track listing and an interesting sample here as well.
All you children gather round, we will dance and we will whirl. All you children gather round, we will dance together.
She goes again. You might tell us, Louise, you were the one that had noted it, I think, who or what that sample is on All the Children, All You Children, which is the title of the track from Jamie XX.
So that voice is Nikki Giovanni, and she is a poet and a Black rights activist, and that's from her poem, Dance Poem. So this is one of the songs that gets political beyond that, just being a banger, and it's just about the transformative power of dance. And there is just, there are very nice light nods to the social elements and the importance of dance music, which also falls into the track Falling Together.
Una Doherty, the Belfast choreographer, it makes her point there.
Yeah, and that's another, she does a spoken word piece over the track, and she says, with open arms fallen into a deep dark blue abyss through time and space and regret and privilege and denial, and just dance.
Just dance. Stars from you on this one, Louise?
Four stars.
Four, very solid 4 out of 5. I think you were even maybe as happy, if not happier.
I would go 5. It's been a great Jamie XX week between DJ set and a classic second album.
There you go.
So we're on the XX record.
4 and 5 respectively for Jamie XX and an album called In Waves. Let's move on to album number 2. After a decade away from recording new music, Gemma Hayes returns with an album called Blind Faith. Let's have a listen to a track that features Lisa Hannigan's called Eye for an Eye.
Eye for an eye, we were out for blood.
Give it time, you'll find little lies catch up, settling behind your tongue. Wish I knew why you wanna be seen. Slow dark, arms open wide.
For an Eye, the title of that track from Gemma Hayes' new album, Blind Faith, and that particular track features Lisa Hannigan. And Louise, across this album, there are some great collaborations. You talk about, I think, a sense of community that you got on the album.
Yeah, there's a great sense of community because she returns working with producers that have been alongside her since the very start of her career, and that is Carl and David Odlum.
Odlum, yeah.
And then she's also joined by Paul Noonan, who would be the frontman of Bell X1 and current the Houseplants. And the way that they all work with each other, they have this huge history with each other, just as musicians and also part of the community of the Irish music scene. And there's a lot of growth there because they were all so big when they started out, and there might have been a lull period in a lot of their careers, but now there seems to be a bit of a resurgence now, maybe more comfort in who they are. And I know Gemma Hayes said that she fell out of kind of comfort with her songwriting, and that's why there was such a big gap between this and her last album. She just didn't feel that she was hitting her marks as a songwriter.
Yeah, but I mean, her debut album was such a big hit, really,
yes,
for her,
oh,
wasn't
absolutely.
It?
Absolutely.
How long ago is it now?
That's 2002. It got nominated for the Mercury Music Prize. Miss Diamondite won that year, but it was a great record, a big calling card record, and I suppose a series of mixed fortunes for each subsequent album. But this definitely, as Louise was saying there, you know, it's very much, I think, a nicely understated but confident return.
Yeah, and she has spoken about parenthood and the pandemic being feeding into this in particular, and this idea of rustiness around the creativity and just finding it hard to get to the songs. Does she deal with that in any of the material that she's seen?
Yeah.
Did you get a sense of it?
There's a sense of kind of breaking through. There's a sense of, you know, of perseverance with something. There's also kind of, in physically relocating from London.
Yeah, to Baltimore, West Cork.
In West Cork. There's a pastoral sense here in the album, I think, both in the musical mood and in the lyrics. And she found that, I suppose, and echoing what a lot of artists will say, after a period of barren creativity, then it really flowed after that and kind of...
And there is a gentleness across many of the songs, and that lovely kind of mellow, breathy voice that she has is very present. Perhaps in a song like Hardwired, it's a little bit harsher, if harsh is a word we can use near Gemma Hayes. Hardwired, the title of the song there. Yeah, gritty, I suppose. It's just grittier than some of the other sounds, maybe is a better way of describing it, Louise Bruton.
Yeah, she has said that she rediscovered the joy of songwriting, but a lot of these songs aren't very joyful. It seems that perseverance that Eamon was kind of mentioning, it's this idea that she needs to kind of push on through to be a different version of herself. And I feel like she's addressing a lot of darker demons in herself as well, especially the song The Break Didn't Heal Right, which seems to be a song that retraces her steps, different events in her life that have changed who she is. And she asks, could I be happier now? And that could be seen as a great thing or a very sad thing. Could I be happier now? It's a big question.
All right. Have we had, are we, I think you are making comparisons here and possibly that this might top Night on My Side, her debut album, Eamon.
It's certainly, oh, I don't know about top, it's very hard ass to top. It certainly holds its own against. It's a very, it's an excellent return.
An excellent return, Stars.
I didn't connect as much with this record as the other two albums this week, but anyway, I still got 3.5.
You're still going 3.5. What are you saying, Louise, overall?
4 from me, yeah. I think it's great.
A solid 4 from Louise. Okay, let us move on then to Come and See, which is the debut album from Gurrier's. The band, they say, are addressing the challenges faced by the forgotten and bored youth of Dublin. Here is it the opening track on the album? No, it's not. It's a bit further down, in fact. But it is called Top of the Bill. Top of the Bill from Gurrier's, and it is their debut album, isn't it? Come and See. Who are we talking about when we talk about Gurrier's, Louise?
So they're a Dublin five-piece. We've got Dan Hough, Emmett White, Ben O'Neill, Mark McCormick and Piers Callaghan. The band formed in that very lucky time frame of January 2020. So 4 years later, they have their debut album, but they spent a long time, as Eamon taught me outside, they spent a lot of time planning their takeoff. And I think that the kind of the apathy and the disillusionment that they sing about, that's the things that they were experiencing during COVID, out of work and nowhere to go.
Yeah, there's another track further down where they talk about friends just dipping out.
Dipping
out.
Yes.
Which is kind of quite disturbing the way they managed to do that. But, you know, you get a great sense, and that's why I always marvel when I come in here and listen on the big speakers how different the album is than when I listen to my own puny speakers at home. They are quite socially aware in what they're singing about here.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, very much. I suppose if there is an underlying theme to the record, it is kind of the digital dystopian era that we're all living through, and how we're connected and unconnected and lonely and frustrated and sad. And it's certainly, I think, as a statement of from, you know, kind of a young band, a young new band of guys in their 20s, it really is quite breathtaking.
But I mean, we don't get a bit of a sense of the post-punk element in that track, because there's a kind of this the kind of tiredness of the spoken word element of it. But there are some tracks which are quite, you know, grungy post-punk guitar sounds. Which will that energy transfer? Does it transfer onto the album?
I think it does, because they have a great sense of humour to them as well, and like. There is a lot of kick and a lot of punch to their songs. One song in particular I think is great is No More Photos, which seems to be a really dark twist on what is the club banger, where they illustrate the horror and the beauty of the club and then the post-club chipper. It's a lot of fun.
I heard some of the team when they were down, some of the arena team when they were down in Galway were at the Kneecap gig where these guys supported them, and they said live that Gurrier's were absolutely astounding.
So I believe.
Yeah. Stars from you on the album, though. First of all, Louise.
3.5 for me.
And a half. And what are you saying, Eamon?
I'll go 4.5.
Ooh. You're going 4.5. Well, why wouldn't you? So there'll be three enjoyable albums from, it would seem, for both Eamon Sweeney and Louise Bruton this evening. Come and See from Gurriers, Blind Faith from Gemma Hayes, and In Waves from Jamie XX. And that's our lot for this Friday evening and for this week here on Arena. Liam Murphy researched. Dolly Hamilton was the broadcast coordinator. James Feeney was on sound this evening. And the programme was produced by Reg Luby. Back with you Monday, 7 o'clock here on RT Radio 1. John Creedon will be with you after the news.